And we are live. Welcome to episode 3705 of the Survival Podcast. We're going to be talking about a very, very serious subject today with our guest, Ken Hardy. Most of us, that's an overstatement. I hate when anybody uses everybody or we all, because that's always BS. But most of the people in this audience who at least live somewhere where they legally can probably own firearms, and most of those people probably carry, whether they carry under constitutional carry or they carry under a concealed weapons permit or whatever your state calls that piece of paper. And we do that because we're preppers. We prepare, and one of the things we prepare for is the horrible concept that at some point somebody may attempt to harm us in such a way that we're required to take another human life, or that we may be somewhere where somebody's trying to harm somebody else in such a way that we take a human life. And I am probably one of the biggest advocates for, I'm not even going to say Second Amendment. I'm going to say the right to self-defense there is in the world. I believe the Second Amendment is a protection mechanism of an inherent right. And I believe that if somebody is trying to unalive you and you have to unalive them back, I hate it, but that's the way that it is. Like, the person that is the one minding their own business, doing their own thing, going on a life, that is the actual victim, is the person that should be held up as an example to others, even though I don't want to ever be that person. On the other end, I remember the last time we really got deep into this, I had a Masada Yub on about it, and he said when the state shows up, their enforcement agents, the police, the bad guy, you know, depending on how things go down, is doing a pretty good idea, job laying on the ground and being a victim in the mind of the state. A human life has been taken. This requires investigation. And that means this is a serious matter. And you can end up in all kinds of hell depending on the exact circumstances, your ability to show those circumstances are as you've reported them, along with where are you? I mean, if you guys remember during the BLM riots, two people, a husband and wife, defended their property with firearms. And we all remember the gal. She didn't look that great with her revolver like this or whatever. But all they did was stand on their own property, demonstrate that they were armed. They discharged, and they still ended up prosecuted. So it is always the potential that you could end up in a court of law defending your own freedom and right to exist as a free person because you have used lethal defense as the law allows. And even though you did that, you could end up there. Our guest is here today to talk to us about how to try to avoid being prosecuted, but if you are, what you can do about it. And again, this is something we've talked about a few times over the years, probably not nearly enough after 3,700 plus episodes. So I'll have Ken on in just a moment. We'll be talking about all that. Before we do, let's go ahead and remind you guys that I have a book, and I would really like it if you guys could do me some favors. One, a lot of you have bought this book. We've sold thousands of copies already. But when I look at thousands of copies, I'm grateful. But you see this right here where it says 61 reviews? I need more reviews. If you've bought my book, please consider giving us a review. If you bought my book where we had the wrong edition uploaded in the first run of printing and it took over a month, even though we fixed it almost immediately to get rid of it, you have a collector's item now. And I just want you to know that the corrected with the proper typesetting and all version is now shipping, has been for about 3 weeks now. So if you'd want like to have the collector's edition and the proper edition, pick up another copy. And if there's anybody in your life that you think could benefit from the type of stuff we've been talking about here on this show for 17 years now, someone who maybe needs a little more direction in their life, this book is a collection of the philosophy by which I built the success of my life that I have. And my whole point that I make in the book several times is the reason I know it works is it worked for me, and I'm nothing special. And our young people really need a sense of direction. They need a compass. And instead of this book telling them what to think, this book tells them how to think. The conclusions they draw are their own. I don't know if we've ever had a time when the youngest generation among us, the youngest generation of adults, teenagers into adulthood, let's say 15 to 35, needed that more than they do right now. Give this book as a gift if you've already read it for yourself. And that includes if you've read it and you're good, you don't need to save that copy. hand it on to somebody else. I'm not saying this just to shill more books. I'm saying this because I want this book to reach as many people as possible. And that's why I really appreciate those of you guys who have picked up the actual soft cover copy, because it can be handed on. Anyway, I really appreciate all of you. We still do pretty well on all of the categories as far as the bestsellers list on Amazon. We're not number one or top five anymore, but that's to be expected after the big surge in the beginning. But we're still doing really well. And thank you to all of you who have helped. And yes, I'm still working on Laws of Life 2. I actually just finished chapter 5, full finish and proofreading right before I got on with our guest today. And on that note, let me welcome our guest, Ken Hardy. Ken, welcome to the Survival Podcast.
Thank you, Jack. I appreciate the invitation and the opportunity.
Well, hey, I was really excited when I got your application to be on the air. This is a topic that's a tough topic. I hear a lot of people say things all the time that kind of like, well, if they do that, I'll shoot them. And, you know, I think that there's a, I mean, my audience, understand, we have a tremendous number of veterans, and there's a dark humor among veterans that is understood by other veterans, but often not understood by people standing by and that are not kind of the initiated, not one of us. And they take that literally. I think that's incredibly dangerous. And so I think it's going to be a great topic. But before we dive into it alone, I would just like you to tell people your background and how you ended up working with a company now that actually provides insurance in case this happens. But let's go back way before you started. Like, what is your background and what led you to it?
I've had an interesting journey. I had a 12-year career in law enforcement in my home state of Ohio. Circumstances in my life led me to shift gears. I decided law enforcement was no longer for me. Actually got into the scuba diving world, and I was living in the Florida Keys doing the Jimmy Buffett thing for a long time, running charter boats and stuff. And then kind of migrated into being a manufacturer's representative in that scuba diving industry, and then found myself in the mountains of Western North Carolina, found myself evangelizing, if you will, about this topic. And it's something pretty near and dear to my heart because of my philosophy and my understanding of the judicial system and how the whole criminal justice thing works. And how it can be a horror story for people that decide to be vigilant and even to take it a step further in their vigilance, carry a firearm. And, as you mentioned, you know, well, I'll just take him out or whatever it was, you know, I'll just take care of that guy.
Yeah.
Well, it becomes much more complicated after that. And unfortunately, most people have a vision of our judicial system and the law from what they watch on TV, what they see in a movie, and they see it all unfolding, but they don't see the complication that it is. They don't see the life-changing event that it is. And most importantly, they don't see the financial aspect of it that is going to be devastating.
Yeah, I think the timeline is drastically abbreviated too. And depending on whether or not you get bail and what kind of limbo your life is, even if you do, that's really an issue too for people to have something hanging over them for that long. For instance, one of the shows that my wife and I actually really like is a show called Bull. I don't know if you're familiar with it. It's a legal show, and there's a lot of truth and fiction in it, like any of these shows, but it's told from the courthouse timeline. And there's a lot of stuff in it that's like too high tech to exist. But I told my wife one night, I said, you know what's most unrealistic about this? And she's like going on to some of the stuff that, you know, is pretty technically BS. I said, no, the timeline is, because these people are charged with a murder or a serious crime, you know, like on August 1st, and they're doing jury selection on like August 15th.
Yeah.
And if you're charged with murder, you're not going to trial that quick. I mean, the speedy trial thing has been kind of just nuked. That can be a murder charge, it can be a year or more before you step in a courtroom, other than to see if you can get out on bail.
That's true. And the problem with it is that it becomes an anxiety inducing event, because it's pretty hard to dismiss. Well, I'll just go back to my normal life and operate the way I used to after I'm facing homicide charges.
Yeah.
And that's a heavy hit. And it's I think the biggest aspect of that is you realize at this point you don't have the control over your life that you had before the event.
Correct. So let's start off with that. What really happens after you defend yourself with a gun? And let's imagine this is a completely legitimate defense of yourself or others under the law of your state, but maybe it doesn't even matter that that's true, at least initially.
Well, there are people will ask me questions about what should I do in one situation versus another. My answer is always, it depends. So to kind of answer your opening question here, it depends. It depends on what kind of an agency responds. It depends on witnesses who witnessed it. It depends on the anti-Second Amendment, anti-gun proactivity of the local prosecution and the community. You're going to be treated a lot different in a small town in Kansas than you will in, say, New York City or what have you. So there's so many factors that play into that affect the situation. But to kind of dive deep into what happens, and I say this to groups that I speak to, what happens to you after you shoot and kill someone in self-defense? What have you become? And it's interesting to me and fascinating to me, in a group of people, I get almost no response until somebody meekly in the corner says, homicide? Yes, you are now a homicide suspect. There is no other scenario. You went from law-abiding citizen, enjoying your life, to experiencing an unfortunate sequence of events that led you to take a human life. And now you are now a homicide suspect, and you may have only ever had any conflict with the law in a speeding ticket. And now you went to a capital offense murder investigation, and you're the subject of that investigation. And there is no way to make that better for good people. The system acts as it acts. So the police will respond depending on the competency and experience of those police that respond, can have a big effect on the outcome of your case. You're going to be handcuffed. You're going to be searched. You are going to be detained. And I always, and this is just a little bit, I feel what I do is educational in nature. That's my purpose, my mission in this. But I'll ask a person, so are you under arrest? And they're like, no, they haven't read you your rights. Well, that's got nothing to do with it. If an officer detains you, you're under arrest. He has arrested you from your freedom to move about at your own discretion. And people think it has to have, and of course this comes from improper concepts from TV and movies and stuff. And the minute a police officer says you can't leave, you are under arrest. Whether you're going to be charged is another thing, and that's a whole different aspect of it. So you're going to be going through all of that. There's so much that happens in a homicide or a self-defense incident where you've inflicted serious physical harm. It's going to get complicated from there on out. From the legal aspect, from the financial aspect, from the life change aspect, and the emotional and psychological effect of knowing you have taken a human life. One of the books I really like that I've read is by Lieutenant Colonel David Grossman. It's called On Killing, and he talks about the psychological effect of killing, and how when you look at military folks that have been trained to kill, they come back from war after they've killed, and most all of them have some kind of psychological dysfunction as a result of what they've had to do. And the circumstances of it change how much effect it has on them. So this thing can be a very deep dive into what happens. But the next step in this is, if the police decide that they have enough to hold you and charge you, if they're anticipating that you would be charged with, let's say, homicide or first degree murder or manslaughter, whatever it might be, that's going to be determined at a later date, not there on the scene. So the next thing you may find yourself is transported to the local county jail. And I don't know if you've ever been in a county jail. They're not nice places. They don't turn down your covers at night and put a mint on your pillow. And yeah. the people in there are not always the nicest people. And some of them may be just like you, an individual who found themselves in a bad situation. But you now have no control over the next steps of your life. And the next thing that will happen is there will be a review of the case. And a prosecutor may decide, you know what, you didn't have enough cause to use deadly force in self-defense. Or they'll just ignore it, depending on their advocacy about firearms and the Second Amendment. And the sad part of all of that is that prosecutors hold within their power, within their hands, so much power over an individual's life just on a decision they rightly or wrongly make. And you made a good point about the timeline of stuff. People are like, yeah, but I've got my right to my day in court. Yeah, your day in court might be 18 months out from now. And there's a lot of stuff going on in the meantime. Yeah, and so kind of where I come in with the work I actually do, and I find this another fascinating aspect of people who are in a concealed carry class or a self-defense basic pistol class or whatever. I will ask them, if you shoot and kill someone, what do you need next? I get silence in the room. And the answer is a good, competent criminal defense attorney. And the problem is that people have no concept of what that's going to cost them. And I've stolen this line, but I like this line a lot. You can get all the justice you can afford in the U.S. justice system.
Mm.
And it's all about what you can afford, what you have access to. In my days in law enforcement, the one thing that kind of, who knew at this stage of my life that I'd be doing what I do based on something that stirred my senses back in my law enforcement career when I was a younger man. But I was very keenly aware that people that had no money usually don't have resource of any kind, and they don't have the kind of money it takes to hire a Don West or one of those experienced criminal defense attorneys that has been through the bloodbath of a legal defense, self-defense situation. So you get some young guy that doesn't know what he's doing. He's afraid of the judge. I want an attorney that the judge is afraid of. I want an attorney who says, I've been here before. I know how these things come out.
And if you get a public defender, right, you're going to get that's the guy that graduates at the bottom of the law class, right?
Yep.
Like when the state hires public attorneys, they take the best ones and they make them prosecutors, and they take the poor performing ones and they make them defenders because they want to win.
Right. Right. That's an interesting point. Win is what matters to prosecutors.
Yeah.
And I say this in the context of, you know, a lot of prosecutors, they're it is a political position. It really is a political position. And a lot of them have political aspirations, and their thought is, you know what, I could be a senator from my state someday.
Yeah.
And how do I prove to my constituents that I'm a law and order candidate? I prosecute the hell out of people. And how do I know that I'm going to get a win? How do I know to push that prosecution if the defendant has a public defender?
Yeah.
Or a non-recognized, incompetent, or not so qualified criminal defense attorney.
Yeah, I would put it this way. This has been my experience in talking to a lot of people. You know, been doing this 17 years now. There are prosecutors. It's not even that they're any gun. It's that they're exactly what you just said. They want to win. And if they look at a case and they think, I can win, they don't really care if the guy's guilty. They care, can I win? And they actually have this twisted sense of morality where they justify it like, well, if I can win, then I should win. If I can win, then I should prosecute the case. That's what I'm here to do. I'm here to get a conviction. And if I go throw murder one at this guy and we offer him some lesser degree of charge where he's only going to do 10 years, only a decade of his life, only be a felon for the rest of his life, and he doesn't think he can win, even if he could win, even if he would win if we went to trial, he'll probably capitulate, and I get to check the conviction box on a murder charge. Even if it's a lesser murder charge, it's still a murder charge, and I got you. Right? And it's not about justice at that point. It's about a W for the guy that's doing the prosecution.
Well, unfortunately, and you mentioned the word morality of the whole situation, there has to be, or there should be, a certain amount of morality and sense of fairness in people who hold those positions. And unfortunately, their vision is about the win.
Yep.
It is about the win. And this is where I get really evangelical about the work I do, because I see people taking the time to take a concealed carry class, or they're going to start packing a firearm, and they're very sure of themselves about when they can and when they can't, because we have stand your ground laws.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that doesn't mean a thing if the rest of the elements of your event don't match up to you being able to stand, you having the right to stand your ground, because some of it just gets ignored. And that's part of the other problem of the system. It just gets ignored. Well, we're not too worried about that. We know he shot and killed him, and there was some kind of verbal altercation. So we're just going to charge him with manslaughter, and we'll take a involuntary manslaughter charge. He can do 18 months in the penitentiary, and then he'll be on probation, and as you said, forever a felon.
Yeah. And it's, we don't know what juries are going to do. I mean, that's the other side of it, right? Like, you can be completely right, but that prosecutor can appeal to the jury's own sense of morality or emotion. Like, if this person hadn't drawn his weapon, it would have never become a lethal conflict, even if after you drew the weapon is when they claim it. Okay, at that point you were defending yourself, but you drew the weapon. Like, there's a thousand ways this can go wrong. I mean, how can a person who basically does all the right things even does what they should do at, like, when the cop, like, you're done, you call the police, you make a very brief statement stating your facts, and you say, I want to confer with counsel. That's what Mossad teaches to do. He's like, if you just go immediately dead silent, that's probably, he's like, you have to understand that usually when someone immediately shuts up, and usually when cops are dealing with somebody doing that, they're actually the bad guy. So when you don't want to say too much, but you do want to give an account. I was here, this happened, I did this, and then I called you, and you shut up. I don't know if that's the same advice you would give, but that's what he teaches in his course. And a person does all that, how can they still end up sitting in front of a judge and facing a literal fight for their life?
Well, I would agree with Mossad's advice, first of all, because I respect him and his knowledge. And, of course, it is the right advice.
Okay.
It's not just his opinion. It's the right advice. And you do have to be careful if you just go, I'm not talking to you guys. Well, yeah. Now you got an attitude, and now the cop decides, you know what, you're an a-hole. And I'm going to do what I can here because you don't look like somebody I like. I mean, yeah. There are so many subjective things that play into all of this scenario of self-defense or the law in general, whether it's speeding tickets or burglaries or whatever it is. The law in general is far from perfect, and the system is far from perfect, and it works at its discretion. To the extent that people take off time from work because there's a hearing scheduled, and they go sit through a whole entire court docket only to find out, oh, your case has been postponed. Nobody told you? So a guy loses a day of work and all the kind of things that go on. It's a very inconvenient process to find yourself in the middle of. And I kind of feel it's my mission at this stage of my life to be out there educating people. Yep, I support your right to carry a firearm. I support the Second Amendment. But damn it, get some training. And I'm not even talking about firearms training. I'm talking about training in knowledge of the law, in situational awareness so that you can avoid a situation. But unfortunately, there are too many people just loading up a firearm and putting it in their belt and they have no idea what's the right and wrong thing to do next. Mm. And they stand kind of on a moral high ground of thinking, I did it right. I'm a good guy. Well, I have a personal acquaintance who spent 10 years on death row for a murder he didn't commit. And he made mistakes. He was young. He didn't know any better. Didn't have money for an attorney. The cops didn't like his looks and his demeanor. They decided that he was their guy, and he went in and had conversations with them, and they asked the kind of questions that you can never give the right answer to if you are innocent. And he there was bad forensics testimony and examination, and it all cost him 10 years of his life on death row, and he didn't do it. His only offense was he knew the person who was murdered. And everybody thinks it has to be very scientific and a lot of evidence that leads to you being the guy, and it doesn't. Because, and I think you mentioned it earlier, the prosecutor will appeal to the emotions of the jury. And juries aren't always, they're not always the people I would want making decisions about the future of my life based on somebody creating a theatrical presentation to them.
Gotcha. I mean, basically what you're saying is that really good people who really did do the right thing can end up facing very serious charges, either through no fault of their own or through making mistakes, especially after the fact. Example, when I had Massad on, an example he gave, there was a guy that he ended up, I think, testifying for, helping on the case in some way, but the guy made a huge error that he probably would have never even ended up prosecuted had he not done it. He owned some kind of a store, and he kept getting robbed. So he got a gun, but it was getting robbed after hours. It was getting robbed in the, you know, when he wasn't there. So he started sleeping in his store. And, I mean, this guy had been robbed, you know, I don't know, 20 times in a year, and the police were literally not taking it seriously. So he's there, the guy breaks in, and he confronts him, and the guy comes at him, and he shoots him. But when he calls 911, he says the phrase at some point, I got one of them. Whoops. I mean, that, and of course, that's going to be played to a jury. So you set up with the intent of murdering a person, right? That's how that got presented. And I think the guy eventually beat the charge, but it was, like he said, it was one of the most difficult situations in which the good guy actually won in the end that he's ever seen.
It those little minute details like that. And as you were starting to tell that story, I'm thinking that the premise of that case would be you put yourself in jeopardy in an after hours situation in your store. I mean, I can even see him taking that element to the next level and saying you didn't have to be there and you didn't have to shoot the guy. Because you're playing on the emotion of the people that are going to make that decision. And you're going to have somebody going, yeah, he laid in wait for this guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It probably would have been better to say, I spent the night in my store because I worked late.
It is all about the terminology. Yeah. Exactly. I mean, I happened to be in the store. I was cleaning some stuff. Had my phone.
His store, he has every right to be there whenever the hell he wants.
Yes.
To, right?
Right. Yeah. But when it gets into the judicial system, it gets convoluted. And it can be presented in such the average person, a person that's got good common sense would say, yeah, I can see you got sick of getting robbed. The police couldn't do anything about it. Your alarm system wasn't solving the problem. You decided you were going to take it into your own hands. I think that's kind of the American way that we do take things into our own hands. But in the judicial system, they're going to present that a human didn't have to die if you just wouldn't have stayed late in your store.
What is a self-defense shooting typic? I know it depends. When you said that, you created laughter in the live folks because that's if you asked a question and you said, how does Jack Spirico answer a question? Anybody in my audience would say it depends. And they would say, well, yeah, I know that. But how would he? No, he always starts with it depends. Like that's my go-to line. So right. I know it depends. But like a typical as we can make it, self-defense shooting, pretty cut and dry. Like the honest observer would say this guy defended his life or somebody else's. What does it look like start to finish?
Well, pretty much as I described as far as the sequence of events after the event. At that point, then you got a lot of things going on. You're removed from your family. If they decide that they're going to detain you, and pending charges or pending review by the prosecution or pending a grand jury investigation or grand jury hearing, you're sitting in a county jail probably. And if you don't know how the system works, you don't know what to do. And most likely, if it's a deadly force case where someone has died, your bond is so high, the average person it's not reachable for. And a lot of times, even the bail bond aspect of it is so high that it's not reachable. If they put a $500,000 bail bond on you and you go to a bail bondsman and he's getting 10% of that, you still got to come up with 50 grand to get yourself out of the county jail. Now you're sitting in this community of people who are what I call jailhouse lawyers, and they're all telling you what to do and what you shouldn't do and all that kind of stuff. And that's bad advice.
Yeah.
So the next step in this is, and usually probably what happens if you haven't forearmed yourself, the next step is your family is scrambling to find an attorney. And most people who have no conflict with the law do not know where to start, where to begin, what to look for in a competent criminal defense attorney. And here comes the real hard part. Once you find a competent criminal defense attorney, you're going to lay out between $60,000 to $100,000 in a retainer fee to take that case. Mm. Now, we call it a self-defense shooting, but the real crime is it's a murder. It is a homicide. A death by other than natural means is a homicide. A construction accident is investigated as a homicide where someone dies. So you're under a homicide investigation, and that attorney is going to take that as a homicide potential charge, or you may have been charged, and now you're facing this homicide investigation or a homicide charge. And the retainer fee for a competent criminal defense attorney, because we know this in the realm in which I work, is between $60,000 to $100,000. Probably closer to the 100 grand side, the more competent your criminal defense attorney is. And that's not a package deal. It is simply the retainer to get the case going. Attorneys work on time and they bill by time. So the time they take to work on your case is clipping off hundreds or thousands of dollars an hour. Yep. So it doesn't take long to burn through all of that money. And when that attorney has burned through that retainer fee and he says, you know what, I've spent all this time, you're 100 grand into me, for me to continue your case,
yeah,
you got to cough up more. I'll relate a story to you real quick. One of our members for the company I work for in 2014 had been at a motorcycle rally. A guy attacked him while he was on the ground. The guy's wife is kicking him in the head. He gets away from the guy. It's a violent attack. It's not just some drunken fistfight. He gets away from the guy. The guy chases him down, continues the attack, and this individual got away once again. Now, it's what we teach everyone. Avoid if you can. Escape if you can. Avoid the conflict. He gets to his motorcycle. He takes a firearm out of his saddlebag. The guy attacks him again. And he shoots him, and the guy is still able to take him to the ground. And then he succumbs to the injuries. Now, I think that's a perfect scenario where everybody's sitting around having a beer and a pizza would go, "Oh, that guy's good to go. Yeah, that's good, man. That guy was trying to kill him." Because in his mind, he said, "If I don't get out of this, the guy is going to kill me today." That was exactly his words. He ended up charged with first degree murder. Now, and so in that scenario, he didn't know what to do. He needed to communicate with his family, what have you. Long story short, 18 months later, the case was taken to trial. The company I represent actually spent over $400,000 in defending him. Now, that included private investigation and getting records pulled and all that kind of stuff. Right. And the sad part of our system is Had he not had competent legal representation, he likely would have been convicted, but he had an attorney and a resource of people who could shoot holes in the investigation, in the autopsy, all of the things that otherwise would have convicted him if not challenged.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes money to challenge it. Your public defender making $55,000 a year isn't going to send anybody anywhere to do all of that work. And that's the part that drives me in what I do, because people just have no idea.
Yeah. Is there any potential? Let's say, would this ever happen? It's a justified shoot, and you don't go to the jailhouse that night.
Yeah, it can happen.
Okay, it can happen.
Yeah. But who wants to take the chance? in my estimation, knowing that the judicial system is a flawed system, not because it's designed flawed, it's just it has human beings and interpretation and all the kind of things that go into all of this. But it's possible that the police say, yep, that guy over there says the guy was attacking you. Yeah, we found the machete over in the bushes.
Yeah,
you're good to go, but you're still under investigation till you are cleared of this.
Yeah.
So it's still hanging over your head. Now, your best course of action in that scenario is to have a competent criminal defense attorney on your speed dial.
Yeah.
You can call and say, Mr. Jones, I'm facing an investigation. I think I'm okay. They let me go home, but I would like you to monitor this. And that person can interact with the prosecution. You as a object of the investigation, you don't have the ability to call the prosecutor and say, hey,
you
where
could are you anyway, right? I mean, that's probably stupid, even if they will talk to you.
Exactly. It's stupid. So what you want, you want a guy who calls the prosecutor and says, hey, I'm so-and-so. And the prosecutor goes, oh, I know who this guy is. He's a tough one if you go to trial against this guy. So now you've got that respect going on where that guy says, look, I want to know where you're at with this. And if the prosecutor says, yeah, your guy's good, tell him not to worry. We're going to clear this and he can go on about his life. Now, that's all well and good. You are over that part of it. But there is an emotional and psychological aspect of taking a human life that affects nearly everyone. I think there are some people that can handle that okay, and say, you know what, it'd have been him or me, but taking a human life, watching the life drain out of their eyes is something not a lot of people experience. And for most people, there's an emotional and psychological aspect and cost to that.
Before we get into that, because that leads to civil too, and we want to touch on that, but before we even do that, let's talk about this. You're a prosecutor, and put yourself in that mindset. You've worked with prosecutors as a law enforcement officer, and I'm sure you've been on both sides of it where the prosecutor goes after somebody, and maybe you're like, man, I don't know if you should be doing this. And then there's probably been times where you're like, you need to prosecute this guy, and that prosecutor looks at the W versus L potential and says, yeah, I know, but I'm not doing it anyway, right? So you got two equal cases like that we're talking about. And one's getting a public defender, and the other one, as soon as he hears the attorney's name, he knows exactly who that guy is. He knows he's got experience. Does that impact at all your choice as whether or not you're going to prosecute?
Without question. These guys want easy W's. And public defender cases are always easy W's. They'll just simply say, look, I feel sorry for your guy. The guy that they respect and fear as a defense attorney, they're going to say, okay, we're just going to drop the case because we can't prove it. With a public defender, I know this goes on all the time. They're going to say, hey, I feel for your guy. We'll drop it from second degree murder to involuntary manslaughter, and with a guaranteed time frame of 24 months with probation in 18 months. You look at that and you go, well, okay, it's 2 years. Try to take 2 years out of your life where you can't go to work, where you can't interact with your family, where you can't pet your dog, where you can't mow your grass. The impact of that is something people don't see because I don't think it's exposed to them. And it's a long stretch to think that far down the road when you're simply, simply just trying to be vigilant and defend yourself and your family.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and then, I mean, it's only 2 years, right? And if you're 20, okay, you get out, you're 22, but the rest of your life is effed. I mean, I know people that have put their life back together with felony convictions, but they still have limitations on them that are, you know, going to last for the rest of their life, like their ability to ever own a weapon again.
Yep.
That would be, and so now you're talking about a person who saved their own life for somebody else's, told you can't do that again. Right. That's a huge problem in and of itself.
It will forever change your life. Now, in my take, and I'm sure you and your listeners will agree, someone who with culpability and intention commits a crime, then you need to pay your price, and that you pay that price. Unfortunately, in this self-defense world, you can pay the price of that person who did things intentionally, and your only mistake was being in the wrong place at the wrong time, and fortunately or unfortunately, being prepared to take care of that situation.
Yeah. So let's also look at another vector of attack here. You shoot somebody because you had no choice. Even the prosecutor goes, all right, I'm out. Like, maybe they were dicking around with it, like they were going to do something. They talked to your attorney and they went, yeah, we don't want any part of this. You know who still wants a part of it? A greedy ass ambulance chasing type of attorney who the family then says, I want to sue this person. Right? That is another vector of attack. And you can end up with both of those too, by the way. You can end up in prison and sued, right?
Well,
come at it from the civil side.
Yes, and the other aspect of this that is almost, and I find this interesting, when I talk about the penalty people may face criminally, that doesn't seem to affect them as much as what it will do to them civilly, meaning liability-wise, that they will have to cough up money. And so you have to prepare yourself for that defense, which, you know, a lot of people are like, yeah, he's going to take my case for nothing. But that's the plaintiff attorney, the ambulance chaser.
Yeah.
No attorney is going to take a civil liability defense case for nothing. There's nothing to take a percentage of if you win.
Yeah.
And that can be as devastating to your pocketbook as the criminal aspect of it. And that, I guarantee you, that family, let's say you're cleared of the self-defense shooting, I guarantee you that family is going to find an ambulance chaser. It'll cost them nothing because he's going to go for $1.5 million and tell them, I'll take 35% plus expenses, sure, and you'll end up with about $750,000 if we win and we can prevail. So they're going to take you back to court for a whole other aspect of this unfortunate incident that happened to you in the wrong place at the wrong time for you in your life. And that can, and the other aspect of it is, and just digressing a little bit to companies in the legal defense for self-defense world, very few, if any, offer liability coverage. Let's say you're cleared of the crime and you're sued, but you lose in civil court. You got to come up with that out of your pocket. And that's a hard thing. If you have assets to protect, you may be, and that's a more slippery slope than the criminal side, because emotion is played into all of that part of it.
I hate invoking this because I actually believe the guy was guilty, but it still makes the legal precedential point. O.J. Simpson.
Yep.
O.J. Simpson beat the murder charge, had millions of dollars to work with. He still lost on the civil side, because the civil side, one, has a less of a burden of proof. It's not beyond a reasonable doubt. It's by a preponderance of the evidence.
Correct.
The other side is, in a civil case, you know, maybe you have this jury and they're looking at the parents of the deceased, this mother crying, this sister crying, and they start to empathize. And they want somebody to pay. And there you are right there. You're sitting right there. I don't know who should pay, but somebody should pay. Why not him? And since they're not sending you to prison, they also tend, I think, this is wrong, but people just don't see it as equally burdensome on them. Like, if I'm going to send somebody to prison for the rest of their life, I'm seriously going to think about what I'm going to do. Like, I realize I'm taking somebody's freedom. And I think most people have at least some piece of that. But if he's just paying money, people think, like, people's economic IQ is below the retarded level in general, yeah. Right? So it's already just a corrupted system, because it's a corrupted underlying monetary system causes that. So they're just thinking somebody should pay for this lady's anguish. Or there's another thing we haven't even touched on. You get into the qualification, you shoot the guy, goes through his guts, fractures his spine. He's alive in a wheelchair now. And he's got his side of the story, and I wasn't doing nothing. I was minding my own business. He shot me because I looked at him the wrong way, or whatever they come up with. I mean, that's another risk, too, and that's a risk on the civil and the prosecutorial side, right? Like, you know, I hate to put it this way, but sometimes you might be better off the guy was dead.
Yeah, usually you are. Yeah.
Sucks, but it's true. I mean, I hate to say that, but...
Yep. I keep mentioning this. It's a mission of sorts for me, because what we're discussing right here is something that the majority of people are ignorant of. Even people who haven't decided to be vigilant and arm themselves or carry pepper spray or collapsible baton or flashlights or whatever it might be, they are ignorant of the aftermath. And I will bet you a lot of people, particularly if they've been walked through the system and maybe ultimately found not guilty, if they had it to do over, they wish they wouldn't have gone to the gas station that night where it happened. There's nothing you can do about that. It's happened. Yeah. But there is an ignorance, and I'm not saying people are stupid. They are ignorant of the information.
Sure.
And in my quest doing what I do, yeah, is it a monetary thing for me? Do I work for a for-profit company? But as a person who has a certain amount of unique and specific knowledge, I feel it's on me morally and as a human to share as much I can with as many people as I can about this very topic, because I say this very clearly, even in concealed carry classes or self-defense classes or whatever, I will say, look, if you are not prepared to spend a couple hundred bucks to protect yourself against all of these dangers we're talking about, please don't carry a gun. Leave it in the drawer. Carry a nightstick. Carry pepper spray. At least you won't kill somebody with it. Because it takes it from assault. Okay, could I absorb a misdemeanor assault because I punched some guy out who was trying to take me out? Yeah, I'd probably absorb that. It's misdemeanor, not going to affect my life and my record and all that kind of stuff. But it goes from confrontation to homicide the minute you interject a deadly force implement of some kind. Mm. And I find it fascinating, this whole world of what we're discussing. But I find it it's problematic for me because people don't seem to want to investigate this. Mm-hmm. They don't want to seem to delve into it. They just would. And it's like sending lambs to the slaughter. You know, I liken getting a concealed carry permit without all of the peripheral knowledge as to having two karate lessons, you know, just enough to get into a stance and then get your ass kicked because you don't know enough.
So let's talk about when you need an attorney. And personally, I think, at some point, no matter what happens, if you shoot somebody, you probably should talk to an attorney. Like, even when they say, well, Mr. Hardy, you can go. And even if they hand you your gun back, which probably isn't going to happen, but no matter how friendly Officer Friendly is, you probably still need somebody on your side, because there's a report that's going to go in, and you don't know what that prosecutor who has a ton of power is going to decide to do with it later on, or that family, right?
That's
but
true.
I also think there's a point where you need to shut up without an attorney. And I want to talk about that. I agree with, and you seem to agree too, that like you need to give an initial statement. My view, and you tell me if you think I'm wrong, is any single thing out of your mouth after that statement needs to never happen without conferring with counsel. And then how would you handle it? Because I, you know, we talk about TV shows and stuff, and I actually have a ChatGPT question for you at the end. It's a fun one that has to do with that. But another show my wife and I really like to watch is Criminal Minds, which has a lot of fake crap in it as well. But there was a moment, like I think a blind squirrel finding a nut type moment, where one of the lead characters was arrested right in front of his family for something he didn't do. And, you know, he's an FBI agent leading a team and all. And they get him into a questioning room and they say, well, we want you to answer questions. He said, yeah, when you get my attorney, you can talk. And the detective, or actually this was like an FBI level guy himself, like an internal FBI affairs guy, goes, well, you know what kind of people ask for an attorney right away, right? And the character goes, yeah, smart ones.
Yes.
And to me, like anything after you've finished explaining it one time after I confer with counsel, and if they say anything back, like, but we need you to clarify this or that, what would you say to that?
I would say that is the smartest advice you can give someone. Do not make utter anything. And hearkening back to what we talked about with Mossad, you do have to be careful about coming off as a smart ass, because then you kind of get the cops against you and not wanting to just be impartial and investigate through an impartial lens. But and you mentioned that what kind of people get an attorney. I've had a lot of people say to me, no, I think if I get an attorney and I've shot someone, that implicates that I'm guilty.
Yeah.
No, it implicates that you're smart, as you said, because you understand that even the best of scenarios can go upside down in what is designed to be a fair and impartial justice system. But there's too many flaws. There's too many human elements of it that they can work within and use the power of that office to make your life tragic.
Yeah. Yeah.
I would tell anyone to simply say, my name is, this is my address, my phone number. I don't really want to make any statements. I'll give you a brief synopsis. And you have to be careful of that, because you could say something incriminating. And particularly if in the heat of the moment, you're like, boy, I'm glad I got that son of a bitch. He was going to kill me. Whoops.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're glad you did that. And that will be used against you at some point in the. So you have to be careful about what that is. And actually, you should go over that probably with an attorney or a legal expert and say, what should I say? To what extent should I make a statement?
Yeah. And sometimes the best statement is not one. Like, there's also like a piece of this, and I think this applies to more than just what we're talking about today. It's anytime you're being questioned by law enforcement, and it's that if that cop is convinced you're guilty and they take you into interrogation and you are foolish enough to have that conversation without an attorney present, people do not realize how able to be manipulated you are in a situation where you feel like you can't leave. And the way I'll relate this is, I had some training in the military. It wasn't in special forces or no shit like that, but we had some training about like what happens if you get captured and how interrogations can go and how your mind can be manipulated so that if it did happen, you would be prepared to deal with the manipulation. And one of the scenarios they did with us is they put us in a room, and this is actually pretty analogous to what it's like to be arrested and held, because in the military, when they tell you you can't leave, you actually can't leave. Right. So, and when you're told you're being detained, whether you're being charged or not, you can't leave. So now I'm in this room, I'm being detained, and if I talk, maybe they'll let me out. And in this training scenario, the whole thing never happened that they're interrogating you about. And you know it. They created a false story so they had something to demonstrate with. And the storyline was that you were part of a group of people taken as a prisoner by the opposition. And it's one of the prisoners had stolen the food that belonged to all of the prisoners, and now nobody was going to eat, and they wanted to know who did it. Mm. And you were being accused of doing it. Okay, you weren't taken prison, right? There were no other prisoners. There was no food, so you certainly didn't steal it. By about 40 minutes into that experience, you start to question whether or not you did it. That is something that I have always had some sympathy for the accused with, when they say this guy confessed to something, if you don't have evidence to go with it, because I experienced that, and more than one time, but that was the first time, and it was like, because what you do, you end up building like a callousness to it if you've been through it. But if somebody's never been through that, you got a 45-year-old dude that just saved his wife's life. He's freaking out. He's trying to cooperate. The suggestions that can be implanted in that, and like, look, if you just tell us this, you can leave, and fucking cops do that shit, I'm sorry, then you can manipulate somebody into saying something that never happened, and you can actually get them to the point of at least questioning if it happened that way.
Well, that it's an interesting phenomenon. It's a form of psyops,
yes.
Which the military. I have a good friend that is very good at psyops, and he was in that operation in the Army. And what happens is, strong-willed, strong-minded people that have been through skirmishes and that kind of stuff, are going to be able to stand and sit and go, you know what, you guys are a bunch of dumbasses. I didn't do this, but yeah. keep on talking if you want to, but I didn't do this, and I know I didn't do it, and my mind isn't so weak to think, oh, maybe I did do this. But there are people who are so capable of being influenced that would go, you know what, maybe I did do this. And if you look at some of the case histories of crime documentaries and that kind of stuff, people who confess to something, they didn't do it, but they were either mentally weak, and they're thinking, well, these people want me to say this, but so I'll go ahead and say it, and they're authority figures. I'm just some lowly guy that works at the grocery store. So much of that can work against them.
Yeah, and it's like three people doing things that cops probably wouldn't do. Like, this is full on. But like I said, you know that the whole thing never happened, and you start like, can I get this to stop? And I've seen, like you mentioned, documentaries. I have seen where interrogations have gone on 10, 11, 12 hours. Right. And then after, you know, think about the whole thing. Let's say it's a traumatic event that happened at 8 o'clock at night. A guy went to work that day. He worked all day long. You got 12 hours. You're 8 o'clock in the morning the next day.
You've been up all night.
It's manipulation, but it's also sleep deprivation. It's, you know, I even remember one instance where they basically told the guy, well, if you want water, we gave you some water when you came in. The guy had been in the interrogation for 11 and a half hours without more water. He had one bottle of water in 11 and a half hours. Like, that kind of shit. And hopefully, if that happens, those cops end up under investigation themselves. But it doesn't help you when you're that
person. It doesn't help you. And unfortunately, that, you know, and there in some agencies, that's just that's how they do business.
Especially when they're convinced they're right. I mean, that's the most dangerous thing, is an investigator that believes they're right in absence of the facts, right? What wouldn't you do to put a guy in prison you really believe is a murderer?
Well, exactly. And that is the other slippery slope of law enforcement personnel, because like you said, if they're convinced of it, they're going to make sure the outcome is I'm doing, and they may be thinking morally, I'm getting a bad guy off the street. And meanwhile, they're not. They're my friend Ray, who was convicted of murder, that's what they thought they were doing. They thought they were just getting a bad guy off the street. And unfortunately, he was just a guy unaware of his situation and how to protect himself.
So one of the things you had in your notes is that you may not even benefit from calling a big name law.
Your feed cut out there for a minute, Jack. Okay. Can you hear me?
I said one of the things in your notes,
yeah,
was that you stated that you may not even benefit just by calling a big name law firm. Why would that be?
Well, very possibly. I mean, it all depends. You know, it's kind of like I took my car to a good mechanic or a bad mechanic. They both have big signs out front. They're ASE, whatever, certified. One just a bad mechanic. And so you can't always be sure. You want to be seeking that counsel that is the channel of what the whole topic that we're talking about.
Okay.
Someone who live like the, I don't know if you know Andrew Branca. I think I saw his name mentioned on one of the pop-ups on there. Andrew Branca is a firearms legal defense attorney, and he's actually on the staff of the company I work for. And He tells it like it is. And his book is a small book that you can read in about 3 or 4 hours, and it covers it all. And it does matter who is defending you and who has a certain amount of passion. You want to hope that it's more than about the money for them, that they have a passion for your case, your freedom, and the fact that you you acted appropriately in defending yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. What do you call the guy that graduated at the bottom of his law class? Attorney, lawyer. Right. So with doctors, right? Like, you could have a great firm, but you might get their peon that they keep around for cases they don't really want. You don't know. So the individual is more important than the firm itself.
Without question. It could be, you could get lucky and get some guy out of the sticks somewhere who has skill that just hasn't been exhibited yet and has a passion for protecting you, and he comes out swinging and wins your case. But you need to make sure you've armed yourself with access to an attorney for an immediate response to an incident. Not, I'll get hold of somebody in 72 hours. By that time, too many things can happen.
You've already got emotion.
You got a lot of things. And you want to be able to take your phone out after an event and call 911 and make a brief statement and hang up that phone and then call your attorney.
Next shot.
And tell him or her, and you're probably not going to know that attorney if you're part of one of these legal defense company systems or whatever, but he is a criminal defense attorney or she is a criminal defense attorney who's going to give you the pat answer, and that is, do not make any statements, be cordial, be respectful, and just make this statement. I have an attorney on retainer. I've been advised not to make any statements or answer any questions until my attorney's present. That shuts down law enforcement.
And it does something else too. Correct me if I'm wrong, but now it's not me saying I want an attorney. I've already talked to one, and I'm following my attorney's advice. That's really hard to flip back around on you. I was told by an attorney not to say anything. I mean,
exactly. Because you do shut law enforcement down. They may be like, well, yeah, you want an attorney, but I'm going to ask you a couple more questions here. No. I just said I have an attorney, and my attorney told me not to talk to you.
Mm-hmm.
And it does shut them down. And in today's world, fortunately, most law enforcement are wearing body cameras. It's recorded. It's on record that you made that statement.
Correct. And instead of being a nice, cordial person that says, I just spoke to my attorney, my attorney has advised me not to make any further statement until I have opportunity to further confer, you just said, I ain't talking to you without my attorney. Right. Which one of those, because it's probably going to be played in a court of law. If you're the person accused, which one of those would you want a jury to see? Right. I guess you have to start thinking about everything you do and say from that point forward probably will be seen by a jury. Even if you don't end up in front of one, you should be coming from that viewpoint. But it also just made me think of something else when you were talking about this, about that immediate call to your own attorney. So usually you're not going to be prosecuted by like the top. Like the attorney general is not going to be personally leading your prosecution, which means somewhere above the prosecutor who's going to review your case is a boss. If 72 hours goes by and that guy's already gone to his boss and said, I got this guy, and now your attorney comes in, he may feel pressure to continue with the prosecution more so than if he had been contacted before he made that claim by your attorney, who then said, I want you to realize here's the facts that we understand on the ground, and I'm representing Mr. Hardy. Like, once you tell your boss something, you kind of have this impetus to carry through with it that maybe you wouldn't have otherwise.
You're perfectly describing the internal workings of the process. And my fascination about this whole world of legal defense and what have you, those are the political echelons of things that happen in the situation. If you've just got some prosecutor who's looking at it and going, I don't know, but he goes to his boss.
Yep.
Now he's got to show the boss, hey, I'm a really good prosecutor, and it's on the line, instead of your defense attorney calls the prosecutor and says, you really aren't going forward with this lame case, are you?
Yeah.
And he goes, yeah, I just thought I had a shot, but now that I know it's you that I'll have to battle in court, we're going to go ahead and dismiss this or not prosecute.
You mentioned some examples, but what is a typical cost if you're prosecuted, even if you're innocent? What's your bill at the end of the day look like?
It's going to be, depending on how complex it gets, but let's say it drags out and you have a lot of hearings where, you know, there's a continuance hearing or a movement, you're going to move for dismissal, because those are all the processes once it gets into the system. You're easily going to spend at a minimum $100,000 and upwards of $500,000 to $1 million, depending on how long the case drags out. It's like the George Zimmerman case in Florida years ago. Mm-hmm. That drug out and drug out and drug out. Well, that cost a lot more money. And obviously, because it was high, and also like the Kyle Rittenhouse case, those were high profile cases where people believed in their actions and donated money to support them and to give them the best legal representation. Those individuals were very fortunate in their case. So theirs were probably upwards of $1 million or more. But if you're just a regular guy in some county in some state and it doesn't make the news and it's not high profile, nobody's coming forward to donate and contribute to GoFundMe for you. So at a minimum, if it's a very simple, well, we ran through this and we got it to a point where we got it dismissed based on case law and the defendant was right in his action, it's still money that's gone. Mm-hmm. And I jokingly say this all the time. You can be found innocent at trial. There is no refund desk at the courthouse. Your money's gone. So easily $100,000 to $500,000 on not a very complex case, and anything that drags out beyond that.
Big multi-million dollar.
Yep.
Can we also talk about this too? Like, this whole thing, you can win and lose a lot of money while you're winning, but at the same time, you can also wreck your job, your family, and your life.
Sorry, Jack, the feed broke up there for a
second. Okay. What I'm saying is, even if you win, not only can it cost you a lot of money, it can destroy your work life, your home life. It can wreck everything. What's funny is I'm seeing
it. Well, it can ruin every aspect of your life. The gentleman I talked to mentioned earlier that we spent $400,000 defending. He ultimately lost his marriage, access to his children, all of that because of all the stress put on his marriage and his life.
For the people in the audience here, is it me that's skipping or is it Ken? Because Ken just darked out on me and I don't see him at all, but he's telling me I'm the one breaking up. If you were the one breaking up, not me.
I think it is me. I'm in the mountains. So
Tom says, Tom, who's my tech guy, said it's both of us. That was me first and you second. So,
oh, okay. So
we got the technical gremlins. Anyway, you were saying that you know, you spent a tremendous amount of money defending this gentleman, but he lost his wife and all kinds of things on top of it.
Right. It's hard to even imagine till you walk in that person's shoes what effect it's going to have on you. It could cause you to have depression, extreme anger, all kinds of effect on your life and your outlook on life. Or you may be just grateful and thankful and go, wow, that was a horrible situation, but I came out and I'm going to step into the rest of my life assertively and with my head up.
All right. I got a couple questions from you from AI. I just always find this fun. What do people often do that ends up hurting their case? Like, what are the most common mistakes? I know we hit on some, but are there any others?
I think being uninformed about when their action would be justified. I think that can be something. So what happens is you may have an action that's 80% justified, but there's a 20% part of that was wrong, and you're going to hope it gets skipped over or that the prosecution doesn't pursue that aspect of it. That 20% ignorance of the of situational awareness and what have you could be the thing that got you convicted, or in a situation where you have no choice but to plead to a lesser charge. Talking to the police,
yeah,
and making talking in general, just even going home and talking to your neighbor, and then the neighbor goes, "Well, I don't like him too much," and then I'm going to call the police and I'm going to tell him what he said.
Mm-hmm.
And the next thing you know, your neighbor's on the witness stand in front of a jury saying, "Well, this is what he said to me," and you got to keep your mouth shut. Just being dignified and just stoic and just move through the process and let it unfold. It isn't going to be over soon. It's going to take a while. Reaction to the event, which also involves talking. I guess if I had to say one thing, it's your big mouth that can get you in trouble.
Yeah, and at that point, too, like you said, the neighbor or something, the problem then is what I just put up on the screen. It isn't what you said at that point, it's what they heard.
Exactly.
We've all had situations where somebody's like, "Well, Jack said blah, 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 blah," and I'm like, "No, that is not what I said, and the way you changed it changed the entire meaning." I've even had it said, "Well, you said this on the podcast," and I'm like, "Well, the interesting thing about that is that's recorded. So let's go find that. Let's play that now. See, that's not what I said, but that's what I heard."
Right.
I've even had people fess up to him and go, "Oh, well, that's not what I heard." Well, that's because you were diddly doing on some other crap, which is fine. But now, if you just think about that lesson there, you could say something to your neighbor, and he's thinking about five other things while you're saying it. And something you say about your story brings him back into the conversation, and he's got the middle, so he appends the beginning and the end, and then he thinks about it. Then that changes again. Then he makes a phone call, and next thing you know, he won't speak to you because the prosecutor tells him what? Don't talk to him. Don't you talk to him. Don't you say a word.
Right. And then you find out through your attorney he's on the witness list in your trial.
Yeah.
And I know it's hard in an exciting, and I don't mean that in a positive way, event to keep your mouth shut about it. We want to talk about it. And one of the dangers that people that have not been through like the kind of training and experience I've had, the knowledge that I have, they're going to be so excited. They're going to be chattering like a magpie, and all kinds of things are coming out of their mouth. And all it takes is little bits and pieces to pick out of those sentences and put it into the case file and pull that out later and say, "He said this," and you may not even remember you said it because you were in such a state of excitement and frenzy that you don't even know you said that.
Yeah, if you really need to talk, I understand needing to talk to somebody, talk to a licensed professional counselor, maybe a priest, right? Somebody that can say, "I was counseling this person. I can't tell you what was said," you know?
Absolutely. You have to be this whole vigilance and self-defense thing is more than just taking a class, packing a firearm, looking into the best ballistic bullets you can buy.
Yeah.
I wish people would spend 5% of their time on that and 95% of their time on learning about when they can, knowing the law, understanding what you and I have been talking about for the last 60-some minutes. That is the reality of self-defense. And it's troubling to me. I think I've mentioned this half a dozen times. I am amazed that people will say, "I'm going to carry a gun." And I know a gun in a split second can take a human life. "Oh, I'm not interested in learning anything else." "Yeah, I know. I got stand your ground." I had a guy tell me this today. Well, we've got stand your ground. Yeah, but that doesn't mean.
I mean, you just shoot somebody and say, "I'm going to stand your ground state." I mean, that might be how the left explains it, but it ain't true.
Exactly. Right? And even in your own home with Castle Doctrine, you know, there are circumstances where you could get jammed up. And in certain states, you're required to retreat. I can't imagine that, but you are required to retreat out of your own home. But then there's the other side of this. And I hear this from instructors. "Well, if there's somebody trying to break in your door, you can shoot through the door and kill them. It's your castle." Wait a minute. That doesn't fly. No. And that might be taking the Castle Doctrine to the extreme, where some prosecutor may say, yeah, he was on his porch and he was breaking in. But what if you killed your drunk neighbor who was just confused?
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't justify that action. You need to be able to exhibit that you were in fear of your life. And I'm sorry, somebody knocking on my door and banging on my door, I'm not in fear of my life yet. I'm getting there, but yep. That's just somebody knocking on my door. That doesn't mean they can physically harm me, because the door is between the two of us. Now, he gets through the door, and depending on his size and his demeanor and what weapons he has in his hand, that changes that whole scenario. But honestly, I'm going to avoid shooting somebody if I possibly can, because of what we've been talking about.
Same. And I don't want the burden. I mean, that's the other thing. Like, the burden of knowing you took a life, even when it was justified, is not easy. Yeah. Yeah, we had a person that we just booted from the live chat. The next question from AI was, how does legal preparation change the way you carry yourself? Right? Like, or might you even be a little bit more likely, when necessary, to not have in the back of your mind that I have no one to help me in this situation?
I think it's going to make you more confident. I think if you are vigilant enough and aware enough to know that you have taken care of that aspect of your intention to be vigilant and defend yourself, it is going to give you a certain level of confidence. And it probably means you are inquiring into lots of other aspects of self-defense that are going to make you more competent, more confident, and more prepared for a situation, and most likely to avoid a situation. Mm-hmm. We think, and this is probably a man problem, you know, we're not going to run away from something. Well, if I see a woman getting beaten up by some guy and he's bigger than me, I'm going to probably stop that, except I'm not going to walk up and shoot him. Maybe it's a girlfriend, boyfriend thing, and you're getting in the middle of something you never should have gotten into. But, yeah. but you have to train yourself to be able to process what you see and what is going on. And if you just walk up on it, you don't have enough information to know what's going on. Now, you may have been within 10 feet of it, but you were so unaware of what was going on. When you finally look, the fire's.
All right, guys, what I'm going to do until he pops back in is he's gone. I'm going to kick him from the studio, and maybe that'll get him to come back in. But I'm going to just say that this has been a great interview. I'm sorry about the technical issues we're running into here at the end, and hopefully he'll be back to answer my last question for him. But while we're doing this, I really do want to make sure that we give him a good opportunity to promote his company. And his company is CCW Safe. They have some really great programs, and the cost of most of what I checked out for myself here in Texas is about $300 a year. And I actually think that that's a really good deal. And I want you to think about it this way. There's so many of us that are in this space. Here, he's back. Let's see if we get him on. All right. Anyway, I was trying to pump your company for you. I'm glad you're back to do it for yourself. Hopefully that won't happen again, and we'll give you a chance to do that. So let me ask you the one last question we had here before we get cut off like that again. The fun question AI came up was, who's the worst movie or TV character to model your legal decisions after in a self-defense case? Is there anybody that springs to mind from TV or movies?
Probably John Wick or any of the Bruce Willis movies. I sit and watch those, and of course the world I live in and the world I came from in law enforcement, I watch these movies and I'm like, he just shot up 15 guys. He's off to some other thing. And nobody's like, is he out of control? What happened here? Why do we have all these dead guys? Those are the kind of characters that I have a little bit of problem with. And I think sometimes some people want to emulate. I hope not, but I think there are a few people out there that think that's the guy to model after. And actually, and I love this, these kind of guys. If you know Jocko Willink, he's a badass former Navy SEAL. And he was asked in a podcast, what's your best weapon? And he said, my feet. And the host said, oh, you're good at kickboxing? He said, no, to get out of there. And now this is a guy who would kick your ass if you got in the scenario where he had to, without question. But that guy's going to walk away from that scenario if he can avoid it, because what's the point? And unless you're law enforcement, unless you're saving another life, which changes the dynamics of the whole situation, the smart move is the avoidance move if you have that opportunity.
Agreed completely. I noticed that my whole demeanor changed when I started carrying a gun in my early 20s. I was a military guy. I worked as a bouncer in a club. I could handle myself. And as soon as I had a weapon on my person, I was actually more likely to avoid a confrontation. It seems like the higher your capability, the more likely you want to avoid the confrontation. And another thing I learned really early on with training was, if you carry a gun and there's a conflict, it will be an armed conflict. Doesn't matter whether you draw the weapon or not, the gun will be present, and there's always a potential for somebody else to end up with it.
That's right. Yep. Yeah. It's a big step when you decide to carry a firearm. It's more than just, I took a stupid 8-hour class in some state to get my concealed carry permit, and I said stupid because they all are.
Yeah.
They're not enough. If they expressed the need for continuing education, not necessarily state-sponsored, but you need to continue your education, this isn't the end-all to end-all here, then I would be okay with that. But 8 hours is not going to give anybody the experience and training that I've had in my life and a long time ago, but it still sticks with you. And depending on the type of person you are, you continue to remain vigilant and train and all that kind of stuff. And when I say train, I'm not talking about being a ninja out there, you know, ready to take on six guys. Just being aware of your surroundings and what is next and what if, and to imagine what if, and to be prepared to respond to that what if.
Okay, this is a good question to just seed right into you being able to tell people about your company and what it does. I'm Your Huckleberry says, why your firm instead of AOR or USCCA or any other firm? Like, is there some unique things about CCW Safe that makes you guys a good choice for this? Did you freeze again? We'll kick him out of the studio again and see if he can come back in. What I'm going to do real quick while we're stuck in this mode right now, I'm going to actually tell you guys about my item of the day so that we can get through this episode. My item of the day today is the bamboo end grain cutting board on Amazon. You can find it at tspaz.com. That's T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. I'm going to be real quick with that today. You guys know you can always support the show by doing your online shopping starting at tspaz, no matter what you eventually buy. This is up for the item of the day today because it's on the lowest price it's ever been on Amazon. This is the best performing cutting board I own. I am a cutting board snob. I own a ton of cutting boards. I own way more than I need. I think they're beautiful. I like them. We go somewhere on vacation, I come back with a cutting board. But the one I break out all the time, instead of it being pretty but functional, is this one. Oil it once a month. You'll probably leave it behind to your children. And, man, I'm hoping Ken brings his butt back in here. I guess the other thing is, real quick, as I try to stall and hope he can get back on board with us here to wrap it up, is, again, my book, Laws of Life. If you have not picked up a copy yet, please pick up a copy of my book. I would really appreciate it. And if you have picked up a copy, you can get the corrected version now if you've got the collector's edition. And please consider getting a copy of that book into the hands of somebody else. And Ken's back. So
sorry about that, Jack.
Again, let's try, like, why CCW Safe versus maybe your competitors? And it really is more a question of just tell people about what you guys do provide.
Well, what we do is we provide unlimited legal representation, both criminally and civilly. So on both sides of that. a component of our program if you choose to buy it, and is included in a couple of other membership plans, which is the ultimate you're putting up there. That includes civil liability should you lose in court. You can purchase that as an option in our Defender plan, which is our pretty much comprehensive plan that covers about all you need. Where we're different is we're a holistic company. We exist for the members. And I think that's, I've been with a couple of other companies in this realm, and I came to work for these folks because of their holistic approach. They exist for the member. We are not insurance. Virtually every other plan out there that has an insurance component to it, and this is the simple explanation, insurance companies can't insure crimes. So if you're convicted, you are now a convicted criminal, and the insurance company can no longer represent you on appeal. So they are bound by insurance regulations that they have to drop you and pursue you for the money they spent. It's called recoupment. And it's something people don't know when they're looking into this.
Wow.
Where we're unique among all the other companies, we have a critical responder program. We have a, we have three actually retired law enforcement homicide detectives who are on staff and available at any moment that we have a member who has a deadly force incident. When we, when the member calls the attorney hotline, the attorney is going to be telling them what to do. In the meantime, he's texting whoever's up in that call queue, get a plane ticket to Albuquerque, New Mexico. We got a member that had a situation. We send a person to handhold the member through the initial stages of the process. No one else does that. There is no one else that does that. And I can tell you, as, and as we've talked for the last 90 minutes almost, that is an important thing because people don't know what to do next. Well, here comes on a plane a guy to communicate with your family and say, we're going to get Bill out of jail and we're going to get his bond hearing arranged. And here's what to expect next. And they may do a little bit of their own kind of internal investigation. They're not there for investigation. They're there to handhold the member, get them back up and running into their life, and then available to them at any time when they need to make a call.
Yeah. And I think one of the other things, like you mentioned repeatedly, that the best thing to do is keep your mouth shut. And I think when you know someone's on the outside working to get you out, you're a lot more likely to keep your mouth shut. I mean, I think that's a huge thing. And you guys actually help with the cost of bond for bail. I think that is something. I'm not sure that the other people in your space do that.
They don't. It's sometimes it's an option. It's not to the extent that ours is. Ours is if you take the option or buy the ultimate plan, you have a million and a half in bond, or as an add-on to Defender.
Oh, damn it! It was so close.
Take care of it, and it's a big aspect to it.
So, okay. Real quick, because I want to wrap up before you lock up like Max Headroom from the 80s again. basically, what I'm understanding is the structure of your company is more like if you compare it like health insurance versus a health share.
Yep.
So it's not an insurance. It's more like a co-op. It's members run for members.
The definition of insurance is shared risk. Okay.
Yeah.
So everybody puts in money to share the risk, but we have no insurance component. We are funded and operated through member fees, member dues. And we are a large enough organization that that takes care of everything to the extent that we even had enough capital to buy up another company in our realm that was struggling and wasn't able to do it quite as well as we can. So that's the key. And if anybody's looking into this, make sure that you're not buying an insurance-based product.
Yeah, I think you gave us a good enough reason right there. Convicted, you're on your own. And they actually are required to go after you who were their client. That's yeah. And good luck if you have both civil and criminal with some of these people as well. I mean, especially if you lose in the criminal case. I mean, then all bets.
Well, you want to be affiliated with a company that has a mission to protect people that are vigilant and are going to defend themselves. Some of these companies have become so large, they're flying around in Gulfstream jets. giving away stuff to induce you to come become a member, guaranteeing that if you don't like the program, we'll give you your money back kind of thing. We exist to take care of our members, and it's a holistic approach. The others have gotten so conscious of money that they are not, they've lost sight of the initial mission.
Well, the site, folks, is ccwsafe.com. I'm going to make sure that links to that and all the other resources that Ken gave me in his application to be on the show are in the audio notes. The audio notes will go live with the audio side of the podcast about 30 to 45 minutes after we sign off, which we're about to do. Ken, I had a great time talking today. Too bad we had some technical issues, but I think the audience took a lot from today's episode.
I hope so. That's my mission, and likewise, I've enjoyed the conversation.
All right, folks, and with that, thank you for tuning in today. Tomorrow we'll have an expert counsel Q&A show to end out the week. And with that, take care. We'll catch you next time.
They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay.